Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard, and I am fresh off of my vacation to Disneyland. And, Disneyland is a strange dichotomy of things. It's incredibly modern in some areas and incredibly outdated in other areas, kind of quaint in some ways. It's a real mixed bag of stuff, always interesting, and it runs like clockwork. It's kind of crazy how they're able to get all of that to work the way that they do. But the thing about that is, much like ourselves, there's a lot going on. Some of it's old and needs updating, some of it's new. And might also need updating. But that's how we all are. That's what we're all doing. I'll give you an example. This is completely devoid of Disney metaphors, I promise. It's something I've been thinking about a lot lately. And the thing I've been thinking about is, how do you know when you are done with your therapist? I'm not talking about how do you know when you've done everything that you can and you're cured and there's no more therapy needed for the rest of your life, because I don't think that happens. I think it's a constant progression as a human being. You just keep working on it. You know, you never chisel the David out of the marble. You just can't. But you know what you can do? You can keep reshaping the clay into something that fits better with your current reality and the things around you that really have nothing to do with you. And who are you going to show up as? Who are you going to be? But how do you know when you've reached the end of what you're capable of fixing with a therapist? And I don't know how to answer that for you. But I can answer it for me. And the way I answer that is when I go into a therapist and they ask me what's going on and I spill my guts about everything that's going on with me and the things I'm worried about and I come up with my own solutions and the therapist says, yeah, that sounds right. And they don't have anything to add, I guess we're done. But it's important to know at the other side that you're never done. Not with yourself. You can be done with your therapist, but you're never done with yourself. So either it's time to take a break for a little while and start implementing some of the things that you've learned, or maybe it's just time to find a new therapist. Not to say anything was wrong with the last one, but you've worked through everything you were going to work through. Not everybody enters into your life for the rest of your life. Some people are there for as long as they need to be there. And that's completely healthy. Now, speaking of people coming into your life, today I've got somebody coming into your life. I've got the great Kenny Weiss. And I use the word great because Kenny Weiss is the founder and developer of the Greatness Movement. This is predicated upon the idea that there is inert greatness in all of us. And all you got to do is learn how to tap into it. Learn how to trust yourself. Learn how to talk to yourself. I had a really great conversation And I think he's got some really, really insightful stuff to say. So I'm going to stop yapping. And we're going to get to the great Kenny Weiss.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me. Sounds like the little bit I read about you, sounds like we might have similar life stories.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about you. Where are you from?
Well, from Denver, and born and raised there, moved here about 5 years ago. I played pro hockey and pro golf, so I kind of lived everywhere, but mm-hmm. Denver was always home. And I guess the short story for me is, you know, as a kid, I could always feel what was going on in people and stuff like that. And we don't teach anything about stuff like that. So my parents weren't taught anything. And I was 10 years old, woke up in the middle of the night to use the bathroom and open the door. There's my mom passed out naked on the toilet. She was an alcoholic.
Oh, geez.
My parents were 16 and 18 when they were married, 21 and 23 with four kids. And as I say, we don't teach anything about how to be a parent, how to have relationships or deal with emotions. So how could they teach me anything? You know, yeah. I mean, none of us are bad. It's just we have a real fear and bias about learning about those things. So from there, I suffered through multiple addictions, a couple divorces. The first marriage, I was physically and verbally abused, bankruptcy, child custody battle. I never wanted to play either one of the sports. And then finally, I spent 3 days holed up in my apartment, trying to write my kids a suicide note. And I could write about the pain I was in. That was easy. But because of my ability to feel and because I was such a train wreck my whole life, I've always been fascinated by psychology. So whether it was counseling or reading for, God, 30 years trying to figure things out. And as I tried to write to justify the choice, I knew too much psychology. I'm like, that's transference. That's codependence. Like, I could not shrink myself.
Yeah.
But it also made me realize, after all the work I've done, why am I here?
Yeah.
And I had some instincts about some things. And so anyway, I went back into my office and I wrote down, I want to come up with a process no one else has discovered that will fundamentally change society. And over the next year or so, I really got into the biology of how the brain and body work. And I had some instincts about some things. And when I did that, I saw these correlations. I hadn't heard anybody talk about them. I'm like, I'm smart, but doesn't anyone else see this?
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's right, but my thought is, well, they don't think they can sell it because it goes to deep trauma and emotions and things like that. And most people don't want to go there. And so that my book became the process of how to, you know, what creates all of this. And then I started the greatness movement, and that's the societal change. And there's really two main tenets, and it's give people this information, you know, the skills and tools, because we don't learn this stuff. And then the bigger piece is there's just a massive fear and bias in society about dealing with ourselves, learning about things. We get very defensive and, oh, I don't need help. And I would like to see what would happen if we flip that dynamic. So,
well, I mean, that's a hell of a lot like to get through. Because that story is so full of twists and turns and, you know, big moments that would change a person pretty fundamentally. And for you to come out the other side to where you are right now, I guess my first question is what was that road like as far as, starting to try and recognize that there were things within yourself that you needed help figuring out, because it doesn't seem like there was a lot of that emotional intelligence going on in the home.
No, I have yet to find a home where anybody has that. I know over 80% of the population says their childhood was great. I can ask them one question and they'll find out real quick, no, your childhood was very rough. But we're so detached from any of that stuff. So for me, it was just, you know, it's helpless, confusing, incredibly fearful. I mean, you know, when you don't know what's going on and what to do, you're just throwing darts at a wall.
Yeah.
And praying something is an answer. But, you know, think of it. If we don't know what to do, we're constantly scared to death. Well, that was my life story. And, well, no wonder my life ended up the way it is. No, I'm not bad. Or think of it. I was just meeting with someone at Starbucks. And I was like, we're having this discussion. I said, have you ever worked at Starbucks? And he goes, no. I said, what if I told you right now, go make me a peppermint mocha? You wouldn't know what to do. You've never worked there. But would you judge yourself or feel bad? You'd be like, no, I just don't know. Someone teach me. But when it comes to these life issues, the exact opposite happens. We feel shame, guilt, all these things. And so that's what everybody's trapped in. And I was trapped in that as well. And so that's why I've started all this, is it doesn't have to be that way. But we have to break down that bias in society. And so, you know, I was petrified just like everybody else.
What did the road look like for you? So, I mean, if we can, let's go back a little bit, because the growing up in a home with an alcoholic is definitely a harrowing experience for a yeah. child, because you're not really ever sure which person you're going to get.
No.
So I guess, what was your process for learning to manage those things?
Okay, I had several things. One, because of my ability to feel, that's why I hate to sound egotistical, but that's why I'm so good at what I do. One of my coping skills was I could tell by the way, well, there were two things going on. My mom's alcoholism and my dad was beat to death as a kid. He didn't hit us, but he was filled with rage.
Yeah.
So I could tell by the way my dad's foot hit the floor what kind of day it was going to be. The last time my mom drank, I was 2,000 miles away, and I just stopped, turned a corner, grabbed a phone, called back, and I'm like, I knew it. So I learned to read and understand emotion, even if not in the presence of somebody. And I was born with that ability, but now it just I became hyper-vigilant. You know, all your words and your actions, I was constantly studying. It creates what's called hypervigilance. I'm trying to figure it out to get myself safe.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things that develops from it. The other thing is I became a surrogate spouse for both of them. My mom turned to me emotionally and go, you know, would say things like, the next time I want to drink, will you just give me a hug? Well, now, unwittingly, she made me responsible for her sobriety.
Right.
My dad would stand in front of me and I had to listen to his, you know, all of his anger. Well, that's why I picked my first wife. It was the exact same thing, you know. So these were the, you know, my coping skills. And this is what we all do. We develop these coping skills that eventually work against us.
Yes.
And that's what kills us. And that's one, people don't realize that these maladaptive, I call them personas and coping skills, we all develop. They're not the authentic us. It's a survival, maladaptive coping skill that eventually turns against us.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah,
because especially with hypervigilance, because that's one that I'm pretty intimately familiar with myself.
Sure.
The hypervigilance is useful in that specific situation where it's required, but everywhere else it almost manifests as an inability to craft relationships with other people and a paranoia of sorts.
Yeah, it creates severe codependence.
Yeah, completely.
I'm more involved in your life than my own. I don't have a life. And people think that's normal. They call that love. It's actually massive love addiction. But that's our model for relationships, is what's called love addiction and love avoidance and codependence. Every movie, every parental relationship we've ever seen is massively codependent, yet we think that's love. We don't know any different. I didn't either.
Yeah.
So I thought it's being kind and loving, being a support for everybody and figuring out all their stuff. Well, no, I was destroying both of us. But again, we don't teach this stuff. So, you know, I had to go become an expert in it on my own to overcome it.
Where did you start? Did you start with therapy, or did you start with just kind of picking up some cues from places?
Well, it's funny. I was in college and I wanted to get into broadcasting, but they kept screwing up the entrance part. So I was just taking any classes. Well, unbeknownst to me, I was in third and fourth year psychology and sociology and philosophy. I was already pursuing my authentic self without ever recognizing it. And so it started there. And then, you know, I'm playing pro hockey and, you know, guys are playing cards on the bus and I'm reading Marianne Williamson or Bradshaw, or, you know, I'm researching all of this stuff, and, you know. So it started there. Periodically, I'd run into a counselor that might talk a little bit, you know, do some work with my first wife because of her narcissism and sociopathy. I was always to blame. We went to 5 different counselors and I'd learn some and they go, wait a minute, you're doing great. What about her? And she'd fire them and we'd move to the next one. But I had no boundaries. I had no ability to say no. I'm like, I'm the problem, because that was the role I took in childhood.
Yeah.
But it was after that first divorce, the counselor I got with there, Mike Pinkston, brilliant man. He's gifted. And I spent over a 10-year period, I probably spent 7 years with him. And about 2 or 3 months in, he turned to me and he said, Kenny, you have a gift. I know you didn't finish school. Go back, get any piece of paper, but you have to come work for me. You're gifted at this. And I didn't want to go through that process back then, but I started running groups for him and working with clients back then, nowhere near to the level now. But that's really when, you know, everything started to explode as far as my recovery and understanding. And then I got into Pia Melody and, you know, just everything and anything.
But that's pretty lucky, because a lot of people struggle with trying to figure out that level of identity, that level of self-discovery and owning the things that you've done and the defense mechanisms that you've put into place, and recognizing how they're not serving you anymore.
Yeah.
A lot of people find those defense mechanisms and they cling to them so tightly because they worked. And then what do you do? It is interesting that you bring that up, though, discovering that you had a gift. My father was kind of the same way, because my father was an alcoholic. And then after he decided to go sober, he eventually became a pretty great substance abuse counselor.
Yeah.
Because he understood it implicitly.
Yeah, exactly. I write about this in my book. Your career tells me what your childhood trauma was. If you're in real estate, it does. It correlates to everybody. Every real estate agent I've ever run into, they were an army brat, they moved around a lot, or there was a move in an influential time. There was some sort of total chaos in the home. And so what's the buying and selling process? It's the exact same thing. I just met with a financial advisor. All his parents ever did was fight about money.
Really?
Every single person, like when you read my book and read careers, I've had everybody come up to me, oh my God, I had no idea this is why I did this. All anyone's ever trying to do is reconcile their trauma. They just don't know. I liken the process to this. You ever watch a 3D movie without the glasses?
Yeah.
You know how it's distorted, the colors are off, but you can kind of tell what's going on.
Yeah.
That's literally how everyone lives their life. It's a 3D movie playing right in front of them. Their friends, their hobbies, their careers, their relationships, every choice they ever make, they're reliving their trauma right in front of them, screaming back at them what they need to look at and what they need to forgive themselves for, yet they're missing the glasses. Well, my book is the glasses. Everyone that reads my book goes, oh my God, now I understand why I picked her, why I like this, why I do this. I had no idea. And it's the cycle I discovered. Nobody's immune from it. And anyone that looks through my book, they're like, holy Jones, I thought I had a perfect childhood. I'm not trying to disparage people, but it's that, if I can sidebar, here's the problem in childhood. We need 2 needs to survive. 1, attachment. We're the only species that when born, if you put us in a crib and feed us, give us water, unless we attach to a human, we'll die.
Yeah.
The other thing we need is authenticity, the pursuit of ourselves. Well, think of childhood. we have to do and become whatever our parents want. If our parents say, you're driving me crazy, what happens in that moment? I better drop my authenticity, who I am, to pursue attachment. And so everyone becomes their parents' unresolved trauma. They think it's them. That's why I played sports. It was to please, you know, all that stuff. I don't want to get sidetracked. And they drop their authenticity. So that's why everyone is doing these things. They have no clue. All they're ever doing is reliving their trauma, trying to show them. It doesn't mean everything you do, it doesn't work for you. But there's a reason for decades, only 7% of the population is happy at work, because they're just reliving their trauma. It's working against them, not for them. And no one's ever talked about it. They just don't know. So, I can go on and on about this stuff.
that's actually a really brilliant observation, because there does tend to be a complete disconnect between people and the trauma that they don't even know that they have.
No.
Yeah. It's interesting that you bring up the fact that a lot of it does stem from childhood. It's a thing that I think people tend to dismiss pretty readily until you start really looking into even just the science behind it and the way that we're kind of wired from birth and they've even done studies where they've seen that certain traumas can be passed down genetically, that's that's really something. But taking all of that into account and everything that you've started to discover in all of this, where are you at on your personal journey on all of this? Would you say that you're pretty close to having yourself unlocked, or are there still some things that you're working on?
I'll answer that. I want to touch on the science, because that's the biggest roadblock.
Yeah, please.
If people will discount, there are countless well-documented studies. You become your childhood. There's the Adverse Childhood Experience study done in the early 2000s, which unequivocally proves everything I'm saying. Over 67% have been through abuse in childhood. If you've been through one adverse childhood experience, 88% have been through two. Your risk for cancer, for any sort of whatever you run into in life, goes up, in some cases, up to 1,000%. It drives everything. You mentioned childbirth, and studies show when a mother is under stress, which is fear, you're in white hot fear, if you're ever stressed, you have completely altered your child's brain development and who they will become in utero, in the womb.
Yeah.
Like, it's documented. Your genes, the way genes are formed, is the constant firing of emotions. There's studies that show that when you fire an emotion, the gene adapts. So everything we are, this is my problem in this field. Everyone wants to make it thought-based. That's why it doesn't work.
Yeah.
That's why all these, it's all feeling based. You become your feelings, yet nobody wants to talk about it. So that's a sidebar. Now, to answer your question of where I am in the process, what I like to say is I'm on the other side of it. I'm still a train wreck. I'm still a mess. I'll never not be that. The difference is, whenever anything is what most people would call bad happens in my life, it's not bad. I know exactly where it came from. I know exactly why I'm feeling that way. I know exactly the process to change it. So I'm at peace. It's like you said earlier, the gift, someone in a show asked me, what do you want on your tombstone? And my greatest gift is that I wake up every day going, where am I manipulative? Where am I narcissistic? Where is my awfulness? I go right at it. The more I become an expert in how imperfect I am, the freer I get. That's why I have a quote. When you learn to forgive yourself, they can't hurt you with it anymore. Yet what does everyone live their life in? I don't want anyone to know. That's why you're in hell. That's why my whole life story and all the awful things I've done is everywhere.
Yeah.
I'm like, I've made peace with it. I've reconciled it. I've gone back and done the trauma work and done all of it and reoriented the original emotions that everyone else is stuck in and replaying in their work and family and all this stuff. I reorient it. So when I find myself reliving it, I immediately go, boom, there it is. This is what I do. And I get out of it immediately without shame, guilt, remorse, all that stuff that everyone else is in hell on. And then they're medicating with booze, pills. Now pot's the big thing. It's, yeah, you know, so-called good for you. It's not. I mean, all these different things we medicate with. You know, now we've condoned obesity with accept who I am. No, you're just stuffing pain. All these different things that we, that's what we do. Instead of dealing with this pain, we then shift society to accept our brokenness. And so now we're just condoning more victimhood, more pain, instead of giving people the skills and tools to turn towards it and overcome it.
Yeah, because there is a big difference between between recognizing and forgiving yourself for the things that you've been through, and recognizing that you are not completely just what you've done, and recognizing that you are a collection of things, and what you've done is part of you, but it doesn't have to define you. And so there's a big difference between that and taking what you've done and saying, well, I can't do anything about it, and so I don't have to change. Yeah. I'm just going to accept myself for who I am, and I'm going to completely absolve myself of any responsibility to do things about it by simply saying, this is how I am, this is who I am, and if you don't like it, you can go away.
Our society condones suppression, repression, and denial.
Yeah.
Just describe, just stuff it. Don't look at your past. It doesn't matter. Just move forward. I'm sorry. The way your brain and body works, the way you process information, the way you make every single choice is based on a feeling, not a thought. It's how it works. And yet no one wants to go there. And so they suppress it. You know, I do shows on positive thinking and how most of the positive thinking out there, you know, there's studies that show if you're depressed and you do positive thinking, it'll make you more depressed. You have to reorient the feeling. That's creating depression. Is I'm emotionally depressing who I am. I'm going against my needs and wants. I'm going against my morals and values. Until you can reorient that original attachment, authenticity gap, you're screwed.
Yeah, and completely.
If you want to talk positive, really all I'm doing is talking positive over that adapted, maladaptive coping skill I sought out to create attachment. Well, that's what has me depressed. It's not my authenticity. And no one wants to talk about that. Wait a minute. I got to do the work? No, please. give me a 3-day change your life weekend adrenaline event and I'm all better. No, it's not that. That's why my book, the title of it is Your Journey. This is a lifelong process. The groups I run, they're 12 months long, once a month.
Yeah.
And body cannot absorb that information and affect change in how everyone else does this in a, you know, 2-day, whatever, transform your life event. I tell everyone to go. They're wonderful life experiences. You will feel great. You will learn some things, but you will not change. You can't. Your brain and body, when you learn the mechanics of it, you realize, oh my God, this is a great sales technique to make me feel good. It's a momentary band-aid over the depression, the pain, whatever.
Yeah.
But 24 to 72 hours later, you crash. There's no follow-up. There's no tool. You're done. And you're right back where you were. And so what do? Sign up for the next one to get your next, dopamine hit.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not disparaging people. I'm just trying to give them information of, look, this is what's really happening.
Yeah, you have to put those things into context.
Yes.
Or you're not getting the full effect of what's available to you. Like, I'd spent a number of years, I was diagnosed bipolar pretty young. And so there was always that roller coaster of, the really high highs and the really low lows. And so, of course, you know, like anybody would, my first thought was, well, let's get medicated and see if it fixes it. And so I did that for a while, and I found that for me personally, it only took me so far. And the next step was, Well, now that I can kind of peek my head above the clouds a little bit, and I can kind of focus and think a little better than I could without the medication, I want to understand the reasons behind my reactions to these feelings when they come in, so that when I am in a mania and when I am in a depression, I can understand it to the point where I can feel that it's coming on and I can react differently. And that took years. I took myself off of medication with the help of a doctor. And for about 15 years, I thought, well, I solved the Rubik's Cube, you know? So I got it. I know my mania. I know my depression. I when I get a suicidal thought, I recognize it the same as, why don't I train these prairie dogs to tap dance? You know, it just seemed that outrageous. It no longer felt like something I needed to act on or do something with. But then the thing that happened was life gets in the way, and sometimes you realize you are never done learning. And I learned that, sometimes all of the coping mechanisms that you've put in place for so long and the coping mechanisms that were serving me for those 15 years, for one reason or another that I can't explain, were no longer serving me. And it was time to admit it and try something else. And so reluctantly, I did. I said, let's try something else. And I think that that's something that's a difficult process for people to reconcile, because getting to know yourself and getting to know the things about yourself, it will serve you for a time, but you do have to recognize that as you change, your trauma changes, your issues change, and you have to continue to evolve yourself along with your issues.
You described it perfectly. Here's been my experience. The way this whole process works is, what I've learned is, when those shifts happen, when all of a sudden the depression or whatever, you know, because there was a period of 2 or 3 years where I never had a bad moment. I was in constant elation.
Yeah.
That started to go away. But because of the years of work, instead of getting depressed and down, oh my God, I'm feeling bad, I started to get excited and I started to pay attention. You know what this means, Kenny? This is the deeper process that I've never heard anyone describe and let people know. This is what's happening to you when those revolutions come in your life. The whole process that everybody's going through is what I call the self-esteem denial gap. All of us, everybody has very low self-esteem because our parents did. I don't care what you say. We're all struggling with this.
Yeah.
And then survive that attachment authenticity gap. We had to go into denial, suppress, repress, and deny the pain we're feeling. So you described it. You learned more about yourself. You accepted more. You saw how your trauma was operating in your life. Well, as you saw those imperfections in yourself and learned to see them and accept them, your self-esteem rises.
Yes.
If now you can accept I'm imperfect, but I can reorient the emotion, not the thoughts. I can reorient I'm achieving recovery in the original wounding and trauma, which raises my self-esteem and allows me to see more of where I'm in denial. Now, what happens is you get joy. You're on this, again, you could say a high, or the roller coaster's going up.
Sure.
Well, when it starts to go down, what that means is, oh, honey, get excited.
Yeah.
Your self-esteem is raised enough that you're sitting on the precipice of being able to discover trauma, pain, and imperfections you've been in denial of for years. It's about to show its face. And the only time it will ever come alive to you and you'll ever see it is when that self-esteem is enough to accept and absorb those difficult truths we all are trying to avoid. That's when I finished my book and was going through, that's what hit me the day I saw my darkness, and I put that all together and went, oh my God, the only reason I can see how awful I am is because I've raised my self-esteem enough that I can accept this truth like it doesn't hurt me.
Yeah.
It's that quote, when you learn to forgive yourself, they can't hurt me with it anymore.
Right.
And so that's what you're describing is when that your mania and then your depression is, oh no, get excited. I'm ready for the next phase. But nobody's taught us that's what low points in our life are about. So we don't have that understanding or the tools to get excited and look at this so-called bad situation.
Yeah.
With the ability to extract the denial, suppression, and repression we're all going through to then raise our self-esteem and move to the next phase.
Well, and those feelings of being down and feeling like something bad is coming or something like that. It's one of those things that's wired into us as a defense mechanism. And you know, in the society that we live in, and in the world that we live in, with all of this technology and the isolation that we tend to put ourselves into now with the advancement of the internet and feeling like we're being social without being social, there's all of this existential dread that is inside of us. And it's a warning that there's change coming, and you can either take that feeling and recognize change is coming, or you can go off the other track that you think you're supposed to go down, which is, well, I'm just sad right now, and so I'm going to either let myself be sad and ride it out, or I'm going to take this sadness and I'm going to completely give in to it until it goes away on its own.
No,
it's just, it's the difference is it's hard to learn the difference between, let's say quote unquote legitimate sadness and an opportunity to recognize that something is about to change and you should flip it and ride that change.
Yeah. Well, here's been my observation. The reason people don't do that and the downfall of the internet and social media is we prolifically reward the victim. It pays to have your life suck.
Yeah.
Post on Facebook that you just broke up or whatever and you get 300 responses of, oh my God, you're the best person. How did that happen to you? Why the hell would you ever want to confront what I'm asking you to confront, which is you picked this person because of unresolved trauma. You're responsible for that because out of the millions of people that hit on you, you chose this one.
Yeah.
That's on you, man or woman. I don't care what, like I was abused. My wife being abusive, while I don't condone her behavior, that was on me.
Yeah.
I was reliving. I don't want to sidebar into why I'm fine with describing why I picked that, but all we have to do is post, and we never have to face it. So we get such a huge reward. Our whole society is based on rewarding the victim and promoting it and celebrating it. And so why the hell would anyone want to go towards what I'm asking you to go towards? You know, that's a very rare subset, but that's what I'm, you know, you talk about racism or the challenges of the world. That's what I'm up against. Wait a minute. All I have to do is make a choice and make my life suck, and I can easily, without any investment, because here's the other thing. This is why everyone's turning to animals and dog pictures are everywhere. Think of it. If I commit to a dog, it's a one-way transfer. The dog is always there for me. I never have to risk emotionally.
Right.
It's perfect. Or cats or whatever.
Yeah.
Same thing with the internet and social media. It's a one-way transfer. I just put up a social media post to how something in my life sucks. All I get, I just have to receive. I've never risked. I've never been vulnerable. It works.
Yeah.
And it's now a great defense mechanism from ever having to look at myself. That's what is creating all of that. And that's what I'm trying with the greatness movement. That, you know, the second phase of it is to get rid of that inherent bias and fear and go against that victimhood and go, no, this is your way out.
Well, tell me a little bit about that, because I I definitely find this really fascinating. Tell me a little bit about the greatness movement.
Okay. Well, you know, there's several things I do. I have my podcast, which I do Sunday nights live on Facebook and YouTube, and then all of the audio channels that we all know.
Yeah.
So that's one way I start giving people the information they can't get anywhere else. And because that's the first place. People have to, the way our brain and body works, the second you hear something you've never heard before, it immediately sends you into fear. Well, I need people to, because most people hear me and go, this scares me. So I have to get as much information out there so their amygdala calms down and they go, oh, this is just that crazy Kenny guy. They're no longer afraid. And they can actually get into thought and process it. So that's one thing I do. The other thing, I obviously work with people individually. And then I run groups, both online and in person. And it's based, the whole greatness movement is based on the concepts in my book, the cycle that I discovered. I call it the worst day cycle. And remember that 3D movie. Very few people are aware of how this process lives out in their life. And so I have my YouTube channel. I have all these ways, because I have to get the information out to calm everybody's amygdala down enough that they'll actually listen to me.
Yeah.
And then once it calms down enough, that denial self-esteem process starts to work. And they start to go, while they reject me in the beginning, after a while, one little thing will hit them. And they'll get in their next relationship and they'll remember me and go, oh my God, he's right. And then they come back and check. You know, it's this very slow process of being willing to see themselves. And so I speak, people bring, whether it's businesses or putting in my own events, you know, I do that as well and discuss these topics. So, you know, I have my book, Your Journey to Success, which is on Amazon. And that's the protocol of the greatness movement. And it's really, the typical member or client that comes to me, they've been to all the thought leaders. I won't mention their names. All the thought leaders we all read, watch on YouTube. They're very profound. I've learned a ton from the programs. They're world-renowned programs that, again, I won't mention their names.
Sure.
They're all great programs, great speakers, great information. And they've also been to other counselors, and then they find my book and my stuff, and they go, oh, my God, this is the missing piece. Why hasn't anyone talked about that? So that's what the greatness movement, it's very rare that someone who's new to personal development will come to the greatness movement stuff. It's too much too soon. They need those other processes to start making them comfortable with actually looking at self-awareness.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's why they need other counselors, all these other great thought leaders first, and then they find my stuff. They, just like me, they see the gap. I can't tell you how many people I've sat with who've been through 2-year programs, done all this stuff. I ask them one question, they go, oh my God, that's it. Why haven't I learned this before? Those are the people that gravitate towards the greatness movement.
Well, and there's a thing that is required of people to reach that next level. And the thing that I think is required is for you to recognize that everything that you don't like about yourself and everything you don't like about your life was your choice. And that's a difficult thing for people to hear and unpack and start to remedy. And then to find out at the end of that, all right, now you're ready to start.
What you just described is denial. Denial is the single greatest killer in society, and I'm the only person talking about it. You can take any issue, political, whatever. Guns is a great one. Whether you want guns or don't want guns, I don't care. I'm fine either way.
Yeah.
But let's think about this. A gun is an inanimate object that does nothing until what? A broken person picks it up and uses it to express their brokenness, yet everybody wants to legislate the gun. That's the symptom. What's the cause? The broken human being. We're all in denial. We don't want to go there. That's where I go.
Right.
And so you take any societal issue, your relationship, and in 2 seconds, I can show you. I don't care how, like, you'll see, if you go through my YouTube channel, you'll see people argue with me. And I just pose a couple questions. They walk right into it and they're like, oh God, it is me.
Oh, but that's parenting too. I mean, the kids are hitting each other with sticks. What do? You take the sticks away. Like, you don't ask them why they're hitting each other. You just want the easy answer. You want the quiet. You want to be able to solve the problem without solving the problem. And so, while there is kind of an issue currently happening with people shooting each other, you're right. The gun is not the problem. It's the people who decide they want to shoot people. That's a problem. Any more than poison is a problem, or broken glass under your feet is a problem. It's like those are all things that come down to the responsibility of the individual. But personal responsibility in looking at your behavior and your actions and how you interact with other human beings is a difficult thing. No matter how well enlightened you are, it can be tough.
It's because we're not taught.
Yeah.
Nobody's bad, but no one's taught us that we're all in massive denial. We don't even know.
Yeah.
Like, I look, you can only do and become what you know. As I say, when you know better, you can do better.
Yes.
So everyone that's doing all this stuff, fighting over guns and all these different things, they're not bad people. They're not broken. They just don't know.
Yeah.
They don't have the information. They don't realize how they're in denial and setting up all of these conditions in their life. I'll say this to people, they're like, well, but my childhood was great. I don't know what you're talking about. And I'm like, fascinating. Let me ask you this. Tom Brady is probably considered one of the greatest athletes of all time to ever walk the planet. Billions of people he's in the conversation, right?
Yeah.
Well, Tom Brady has had coaches and mentors and experts around him for 35, 40 years teaching him how to become this. For centuries, not a single one of us has ever taken or researched how to be a parent. And Tom Brady fumbles, throws incompletions and interceptions all day, every day. And you think your childhood was perfect with absolutely no training. You tell me how.
Yeah.
But you're not aware. Now, we all watch football. We know the mechanics of it. We have the information of what a completion is and all that. So we can see, oh, that was imperfect. But nobody wants to talk about these topics. So we don't even know. The young man I sat with today, he has severe perfectionism issues. Well, his dad, whenever he came home, whatever he did, always told him it wasn't enough. Just went, so what are you going to do now? He was completely detached from, now he says, I have no ability to have empathy. Well, how could he? He had to shut himself off emotionally to survive his dad's assault and dad's abuse. Like, he couldn't even accept his dad was abusive. Like, no, that's massive abuse.
Yeah.
And see, he was completely unaware that, oh my God, the reason I have no empathy when my girlfriend and her father died, he couldn't attach to it. Well, it was never safe. If he ever, in his words, succeeded in life or achieved something, his dad told him he was nothing. It wasn't enough. So what's his defense? I'm going to shut down emotionally. I can't celebrate anything or be involved in it emotionally because I'm going to be told it's not good enough. And he thinks it's a personality trait. Hell no.
No.
This is a maladaptive coping skill. But just like everybody else, he was completely clueless. Not clueless, that sounds bad. Completely unaware and uneducated of the massive abuse he suffered. And that's minor what we go through in childhood.
Yeah.
And people don't even realize, oh my God, I've been through some terrible stuff.
Well, it is a lifelong process because there's a lot of things to do in a life.
Sure.
As you age and you get a little more wisdom, there's more choices presented to you. There are more options presented to you every single day as you move along. And the result of what you took away from those situations is what's going to carry you forward. So taking all of those bits and pieces of everything that you've been through, it's a lot to ask a person to change the literal makeup of their puzzle.
Let me interject there. Why is that difficult for them to process? What are they feeling?
It's fear.
Exactly. The buzzword is stress, and this drives me crazy. We never call anything what it is. The clinical definition of both stress and anxiety is fear.
Yeah.
So you can fear. Now, what's the general program we've all been taught to deal with fear? I call it the Nike philosophy. Just do it. Be a grinder. Go, right?
Yeah.
What are you doing? You're yelling and screaming at yourself, belittling yourself. Come on, you wimp. You can handle this.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, here's the thing about anger. Anger is always fear. Now, here's another thing. This is it. I've never seen anyone break down fear like I do. Fear is always one of three things: the fear of rejection, the fear of inadequacy. In other words, I don't think I have the skills, tools, or knowledge to do something, or powerlessness. So, like my clients or greatness group members or whatever, the second they're stressed and overwhelmed by life and in fear, they can immediately, that's not a thought condition, that's an emotional overwhelm. They can immediately look through their day and go, where did I feel the possibility of rejection, inadequacy, or powerlessness? If it's rejection, I do this. If it's inadequacy, I do this. If it's powerlessness, I do this. Now you have a plan to work through the emotional overwhelm that everybody's stuck in. We haven't been taught. Nobody's bad. They just have never been walked through a class in seventh grade. Here, when you're feeling this overwhelm about social media, here are the three tools you need. Do this, and your friend says something on Facebook, or I guess they're all on Snapchat. This is how you handle it. They just don't have the skills and tools. That's it.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with that more. But it's not that people are not capable. Sometimes they just need the encouragement to figure out that first step.
And so why would they feel like they're not capable? Go back to childhood, attachment, authenticity bind. And when we're forced with that choice, what does it create? That's the second stage of the cycle. Fear. So they're in rejection, inadequacy, and powerlessness. They don't know what to do.
Right.
In that. And so it becomes this lifelong pattern of living in, you know, a high stress environment, which is a high fear environment. Cortisol levels, you know, and so what do they reach for? Dopamine hits, sex, bills, booze, whatever.
Yeah.
Because attachment provides dopamine. That's what we're after in these medicating techniques. Well, we didn't have attachment because we had to relinquish our authenticity pursuit, drop who we are. So now we're not getting that attachment dopamine hit from our parents. Now we turn to social media, all these other things, because they give us short-term dopamine hits.
Right.
Your cortisol levels are through the roof. When you have asthma, when you have all of these stress conditions, you know what they give you? Adrenaline, cortisol,
yes.
The stress response, because your stress response is so overwhelmed, they jack it back up so that it works again.
Right.
That's the remedy. Well, that's why none of this stuff works, because they're not giving you the emotional tools that you need. Pills aren't the answer.
They're fun for a while.
Sure.
but that's exactly it. I mean, those distractions, it's almost like you start teaching yourself through the process of elimination. I'm gonna drink because I know the predictable response I'm gonna get out of it. I'm gonna take pills because I know the response I'm gonna get out of it. I'm gonna lose myself in sex with other people because I don't have my own self-worth. I need to get it from somewhere else. I gotta get my validation hit. And so we teach ourselves these things without actually having a conversation with ourselves about these things, and just follow these patterns because it's what worked before, without questioning, well, why isn't it working now? Why doesn't it work all the time? You know, it must have been something wrong with that experience, because it can't be me.
That's the victim culture. Look at,
yeah.
If anything wrong in our life, what do? Go. And when I said pills earlier, I was talking prescription pills.
Sure.
Look at, when anything isn't working in our life, what's our resolution? Go to the doctor, give me a prescription. I'm not the problem.
Yeah.
It's this phantom God-oriented, the environment, something afflicted me with this pain and this issue, this depression, whatever. You proved it. Bipolar, you went and learned the emotional skills and tools. You didn't need the medicine. Every single depression medication out there, doesn't matter which brand, they all test out within 1% of sugar pill. The exact same efficiency as taking sugar pill. All the drug companies are trying to suppress those clinical trials that show it. Why would depression medication work? Because you feel it might work. Yeah. You make the assumption the second you get off it, you're depressed. Studies show your depression worse for 20, depending on your age, from anywhere from 25 to 75%. When you take depression medication, it makes the depression worse because you're treating the symptom, not the cause. You're not giving them the emotion. You just described it. Nobody has the emotional skills to handle these events. Then the victim culture, the drug culture in medicine and everything is, okay, I'll post it, blame it on somebody else. It's outside of me. There's nothing I can do. Now, why did they do that? Because other than myself, Gabor Mate, and maybe a couple others, nobody's talking about the real source of where all this comes and the real tools you need to address this stuff. And that's the gap in society I'm trying to fill.
And the conversations that I've been having with people about medication, because medication's a tricky subject. There are instances where I feel like the medication can help a person, but the caveat to that is that it can only help you so far. It might be able to elevate you to, you know, like with what happened to me. It was able to elevate me to the point where I could kind of think straight. And put things into perspective. But then after that, it was up to me to do the work and get myself into a place where I was able to manage these things. Because the thought process that I always had was, and this was an obsessive thought that I could not shake, and it was, if I'm stranded alone on a desert island with no medication and no access to therapy, am I going to kill myself? And the answer actually terrified me. It was, I don't know if I would or not. And that was enough for me to say, I have some work to do. Because if I am ever put in a situation where I can't manage my own brain or understand myself, what am I doing? I mean, just in my day-to-day life of waking up in the morning and deciding I'm going to go to the store and get a muffin. I mean, how am I supposed to manage and navigate a healthy life when I'm constantly on the lookout for fear and, you know, for attack from other places, instead of recognizing that most of that is coming from inside myself? It's me attacking me. I've got to stop attacking myself and start learning myself.
Yeah.
It's a process.
And I want to clarify something. I'm not saying you should never take medication.
No, certainly.
What I'm advocating is, for certain people, that's a great place to start. Not everybody.
Yes.
Many people use it as a crutch to avoid. No, but for some
completely.
People, the situation is so desperate, you have to start there. What I'm advocating is, just like you said and what you lived, you started there, that treats the symptom, but then you went and worked on the cause.
Yes.
The emotional content. And when I hear what you just described, you haven't hired me, so I'm not expecting you to answer this. But what I hear in that is somebody who most likely suffered severe abandonment in childhood, was forced to make decisions on their own, had no support system. And so when I hear you describing a scenario of complete isolation, no support, no alternatives, what I hear is somebody who suffered massive, massive abandonment. More often than not, that's what will create the bipolar, the ADHD, all of these things. And so again, you haven't asked me to, I'm just saying, for those people, if your story, if what you described sounds familiar to them, I'd ask them, look in your life and go, oh my God, he's right.
Yeah.
That's where I'm in this.
Well, this has been an amazing conversation. I can't thank you enough for coming on here to do this. And really, honestly, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I get fired from a lot of speeches from companies when they find out what I'm going to talk about. And so anybody who has the courage to go towards these topics, because the science shows it.
Yeah.
Your only way out is this way. That's it. I mean, it's overwhelming. And so for somebody to have the courage to allow me a chance to share more about it, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for talking to me.
You bet.
What did I tell you? The great Kenny Weiss. If you want to get some more greatness in your life, and I know you do, go to thegreatnessmovement.com. There are videos, there are tutorials, there's all kinds of stuff there that can help you tap into your own personal greatness. As for me, if you want to see more of what I'm doing, I'm actually going to be performing as a part of the Queen City Companion in October at the Mutiny Information Cafe in downtown Denver, October 3rd, 8 p.m. A lot of great performers are going to be there. We got Sydney Carrington, Kelly Crystal Love, Jerry Owens, Noah Reynolds, Elizabeth Smith, Priscilla Spangler, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. It's a storytelling show. I would love to see you out there. And as always, don't kill yourselves out there.